Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church, Episode 74, Egyptian Grain. We left off last time in 334, with Athanasius successfully avoiding a trial by the Eusebian Council of Caesarea, after he vindicated himself against the charge of murdering a Miletian bishop. Once again, the Miletians had been put to shame, and the machinations of the Eusebians brought to nothing. The following year, though, events would take a much different course. The year 335 was set to be a banner year for both church and emperor. That July would mark the official beginning of Constantine's triennial celebrations, the 30th anniversary of his rule, something no emperor had achieved since Augustus himself 3 centuries earlier. Later that September, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre would be completed and formally dedicated in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Constantine would complete his new Tetrarchy of Caesars by raising his nephew Dalmatius the Younger to the purple next to his 3 sons. 335 would also be the year that the conflict between Athanasius and the Miletian Eusebian alliance came to its climax. Eusebius of Nicomedia was once again the grand architect of events. First, he induced the Miletians, Arians, and former followers of Caluthus to write a joint letter to the emperor listing their various charges against Athanasius. Violence was the common grievance between all 3 groups against the Bishop of Alexandria. In fairness to Athanasius's opponents, we do have some evidence to suggest not all their accusations were made of hot air. A fragmentary letter by a Miletian hieromonk named Callistus, addressed to one of his peers, survives from precisely this time, though the fragmentary nature of the document makes its interpretation somewhat unclear. The letter appears to describe Athanasius's supporters, possibly former Miletians, viciously beating and imprisoning local Miletian clergy, allegedly on Athanasius's expressed orders. Some scholars have seen in this document, known as London Papyrus 1914, a smoking gun proving Athanasius really was the mafia-style thug his enemies always claimed he was. They furthermore suggest that the Miletians being harassed were intended to serve as witnesses to the upcoming council which would try Athanasius. Other scholars more sympathetic to Athanasius argue this violence was not ordered or controlled by the bishop, but instead represented popular-level initiatives to support him. Not out of the realm of possibility, given the riotous nature of Alexandria's populace. Most scholars seem to take the view, though, that it is difficult to imagine Athanasius was completely ignorant of these events, or that these actions occurred without at least his tacit consent. To address the charges, Constantine called for a new church council to meet at Tyre that summer. Supervising the synod would be Count Flavius Dionysius, a former governor of Syria and a friend of the Eusebians. Also in attendance would be the provincial governor Archelaus, the man who had discovered Arsenius of Hypsele the previous year. The imperial officials also had soldiers present under their command to ensure order was maintained at the council. The plan was for the Council of Tyre to definitively resolve the troubles in Egypt, before then joining other bishops at Jerusalem for the dedication of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. There, Arius and his follower Eusoius would both be reviewed and readmitted into communion. Thus, all factions would be reconciled, and harmony would be restored among believers in Christ everywhere. Constantine would finally achieve lasting peace within the church during his triennalia. It was an optimistic plan, but of course, the biggest obstacles to peace within the Christian church were the Christian leaders themselves. Athanasius could easily see, from the role of Count Dionysius to the planned rehabilitation of Arius, that the Eusebians were the driving force behind the arrangements at Tyre. If he had not been aware already of the alliance between Eusebius of Nicomedia and the Miletians, he certainly was now. Getting a fair hearing at Tyre was going to be difficult, to say the least. Given Athanasius's history of making himself scarce during such gatherings, the emperor directly ordered the Alexandrian to attend the synod. Based on Athanasius's own comments, it is further possible that imperial soldiers came to Alexandria to make sure he arrived in Tyre on time. However, even though he was being compelled to attend a heavily biased synod, Athanasius wasn't leaving home without some backup. No, he was going to bring some of his fellow Egyptian bishops with him. How many other bishops do you suppose traveled with Athanasius to Tyre? 5? 10, maybe? On July 11th, Athanasius set out for Phoenicia with a total of 47 Egyptian bishops. Yeah, being the Coptic Pope had its advantages. The Council of Tyre was presided over by Bishop Flaccillus of Antioch. The main body of attendees, not including Athanasius and the Egyptians, consisted of some 60 bishops. Among these were every single one of the core Eusebians, from Eusebius of Nicomedia himself and his Bithynian comrades, to our church historian Eusebius of Caesarea and his associates in the Levant. This included the recently consecrated bishop of Syrian Laodicea, George, whom we mentioned a couple episodes ago. The Council of Tyre therefore marked the first time Athanasius had come face to face with the Eusebii and their fellows since Nicaea a decade earlier. In addition to these long-standing members of the Eusebian party, the Council of Tyre also marks the first appearance of two new members of the pro-Arian faction. During his exile in Illyricum after the Council of Nicaea, Arius had apparently made some new friends in the form of two young bishops, Valens of Mursa and Ursatius of Singidunum. Valens and Ursatius will show up again and again throughout the next three decades, always as a pair and always as the key western allies of Athanasius's enemies. The other major episcopal bloc at Tyre were the seven Miletians led by John Arcaph himself. Though their status as members of the Catholic Church had been dubious, the Eusebians managed to normalize their Miletian allies so they could participate in the council's sessions. In addition to the Eusebians and Miletians, the synod also included many other prominent and influential prelates from the Eastern Mediterranean. Among these was Maximus, a confessor of the persecutions and the new bishop of Jerusalem. Though theologically and politically more sympathetic to Athanasius, Maximus steered clear of angering the Eusebian-led majority, and sat with their side at the synod. Maximus didn't want anything to sour the upcoming celebrations in the Holy City, where he would play a central role. Though the presence of many other bishops at Tyre, beyond just the Eusebians and Miletians, might at first suggest Athanasius's prospects at a fair trial were actually better, this was not the case. The composition of the synod had been carefully managed by the Eusebians so that, on the surface, it appeared to be generally representative, but upon closer inspection, this was not so. For instance, when it came to bishops from Anatolia, the provinces of Bithynia and Cilicia were duly represented, since they were Eusebian strongholds, whereas many of the central Anatolian provinces, whose bishops had usually sided against Arius, were largely absent. So while not exactly a kangaroo court, the Synod of Tyre was not the fair and balanced council its supporters trumpeted it as. In addition to the bishops, several other lower-ranking clergy and laymen were present. Chief among these were people who would serve as material witnesses. Athanasius's trusted presbyter Macarius had previously been in Constantinople, but the Eusebians arranged to have the imperial authorities arrest him and send him in chains to Tyre. Macarius was, of course, a material witness and defendant in the whole Ischyrus affair. Ischyrus himself attended the synod as a witness against Athanasius, completely backtracking on his earlier recantation. When Athanasius arrived, the Egyptian bishops who came with him were barred from taking part in the synod. They had technically not been invited to the council by the emperor, and were not officially considered part of its membership. Nevertheless, the Egyptians made their presence known. Their numbers included former miletians, as well as venerable confessors of the Great Persecution, including Paphnutius of Thebes, the bishop who had spoken in defense of clerical marriage at the Council of Nicaea. At Tyre, it was Paphnutius who called out Maximus of Jerusalem for sitting with Athanasius's enemies. Another notable Egyptian bishop present was Potamon of Heracleopolis. You may remember from back during our coverage of the persecution that Potamon had once been imprisoned alongside Eusebius of Caesarea. Whereas Potamon had lost one of his eyes, Eusebius was released without harm. At some point during the council, Potamon point-blank called out the church historian to his face in front of the assembly. Potamon insinuated that Eusebius must have compromised his faith in order to avoid being maimed or martyred. Eusebius naturally rejected this insinuation as false, which it almost certainly was, but within Egyptian circles, it became a widely held belief that the learned church historian had lapsed and sacrificed. A highly uncharitable conclusion, to say the least, but in fairness, Christian charity was in short supply all around at the Council of Tyre. The council formally began with Count Dionysius reading aloud the emperor's letter to the synod. Constantine reminded the bishops that he had facilitated the meeting in accordance with their wishes, and instructed the bishops to return the favor by judging fairly and prescribing proper remedies, so that peace was restored between all. With that, the business of the council began. The list of charges brought against Athanasius was lengthy. Perhaps the most colorful charge Athanasius's enemies made against him, at least according to some sources, is that he had violated a consecrated virgin. Allegations of gross sexual sin seem to have been a stock political weapon at the time, as we saw with Eustathius of Antioch. If the story about this accusation is true, then this attempt on Athanasius failed miserably. At the synod, his enemies produced the woman as a material witness, and she loudly proclaimed the bishop had violated her. Athanasius was ordered to reply to these accusations, but he remained silent. Instead, one of his presbyters spoke for him. The woman immediately began to lash out at the presbyter, thinking he was Athanasius. With that, the ploy was exposed, as the assembly realized she had no idea what Athanasius looked like. The miletians accused the Bishop of Alexandria of various violent attacks they claimed to have received at the hands of his supporters. The matter of Arsenius of Hypsele was brought up again. Since his discovery at Tyre the previous year, Athanasius had kept Arsenius hidden in the city. Though many were already aware Arsenius was alive, others at the synod were not up to speed on things. Athanasius therefore produced the Bishop of Hypsele before the council. Furthermore, in a rather dramatic touch, Athanasius had Arsenius's hands covered by a cloth. He then proceeded to remove the cloth from each hand, one at a time. Clearly, whatever severed limb the miletians claimed to possess as evidence, it did not belong to Arsenius. The miletians countered all this by saying that while Arsenius had not actually been killed, Athanasius had still ordered one of his bishops to attack and imprison him, as well as burn his home. So even if Arsenius hadn't been murdered, the miletians were justified in their assumption that he had. But having Arsenius alive and well at the synod to testify, on Athanasius's behalf no less, was too much for the miletians to overcome. For the record, Arsenius appears to have remained on good terms with Athanasius for the rest of his life, and we find him still Bishop of Hypsele in the late 340s, in full communion with the Bishop of Alexandria. The other Meletian accusations came chiefly from two men, Ischyrus, of course, and Bishop Callinicus of Pelusium. They once again accused the Coptic Pope of ordering Macarius to break the chalice, as well as overturn the episcopal throne they alleged Ischyrus possessed in his hut. They further claimed that Athanasius had had Ischyrus bound in chains and imprisoned by the prefect of Egypt on the false charge of hurling stones at the statues of the emperor. Callinicus also claimed Athanasius had attacked him as well. Callinicus had returned to the Catholic fold during the time of Alexander, but when the charge of breaking the chalice of Ischyrus first came up, Callinicus refused to hold communion with Athanasius until the Coptic Pope could clear his name. In response, Athanasius deposed Callinicus and replaced him with an allegedly defrocked presbyter. Afterwards, Callinicus rejoined the Meletians and was a member of their embassy at Samothia back in 331. The proceedings of the synod dragged on, and while Athanasius appears to have provided sufficient refutations of the other charges, the chalice of Ischyrus incident did not go away. Athanasius contested these charges on multiple grounds. He argued that, first and foremost, Ischyrus was not a real presbyter, and therefore no legitimate Eucharist could have been taking place during the alleged incident. The Council of Alexandria in 324 had rejected Ischyrus' ordination by Caluthus, nor did Ischyrus' name appear on the list of Meletian clergy that Meletius himself gave to Alexander at Nicaea, a list which Athanasius presented to the synod as evidence. There was simply no proof Ischyrus had ever been legitimately ordained to the presbytery. Therefore, not only was any worship service he performed invalid, any altar, vessels, or sanctuary he claimed to possess were fake as well. In addition, Ischyrus was on his sickbed when Macarius visited him, and so how could he possibly be performing the holy mysteries? The only other persons present were Ischyrus's father and a catechumen. Catechumens could not receive communion. Furthermore, Macarius's visit had not even taken place on a Sunday. Again, further proof that no celebration of the Lord's Supper was taking place. Athanasius also submitted to the synod Ischyrus' letter of recantation. Finally, Macarius himself also testified that he had not broken any cup or assaulted Ischyrus on Athanasius' orders. The Eusebian-led majority was certainly hostile toward the Bishop of Alexandria, but the reason Athanasius' defense on this charge failed to clear his name probably also had to do with the nature of his defense itself. Modern scholars have keenly noticed a common theme in Athanasius' defense against the charge of breaking the chalice of Ischyrus. Many of his core arguments do not really refute the notion that some sort of physical assault occurred, or that some kind of chalice was actually broken. Rather, Athanasius focused heavily on denying the legitimacy of Ischyrus' priestly status, and by extension, the services and sanctuary he presided over. To put it another way, if Macarius didn't attack Ischyrus in some way, why did Athanasius feel the need to so strongly insist that Ischyrus was not a valid presbyter? This is one of the main reasons why a number of modern scholars, though not buying the more salacious elaborations to the Ischyrus story, think that some kind of violence occurred, for which Athanasius was partly to blame. To settle the question once and for all, the council asked Count Dionysius that a commission be appointed from among the assembly and sent to the Mareotis district to investigate. Athanasius was understandably irked by this, arguing he had successfully refuted Ischyrus' charges. On top of that, one of the bishops who had traveled with him was the actual bishop of the Mareotis, and also a former Meletian. This man knew the situation very well, and Athanasius argued the council should interview him instead. Athanasius conceded, however, that if a commission needed to be appointed, then it should consist of the more moderate members of the council. In other words, it should not include any of the bishops present who were known to be hostile towards him, i.e. the Eusebians and Meletians. Dionysius agreed, but ultimately delegated the selection of commission members to the council itself. So who did the Eusebian-led majority appoint to the Mareotis Commission? The two Bithynian fellows of Eusebius of Nicomedia, Theognis of Nicaea and Marus of Chalcedon, the longtime Eusebian from Thrace, Theodore of Heraclea Perinthus, the Cilician Macedonius of Mopsuestia, another member of the Eusebian coalition, and Arius's new friends from Illyricum, Valens of Mursa and Ursatius of Singidunum. All these bishops were, of course, known pro-Arians and enemies of the Coptic Pope. To add further insult to injury, Ischyrus himself would accompany the commission as a witness, but not the accused party, Macarius. With the commission selected, Dionysius sent them on their way to Egypt with a military escort, and wrote letters notifying the prefect of Egypt, who was tasked with assisting the commission with the investigation. Unfortunately for Athanasius, the current prefect was a man with whom he was on bad terms, Flavius Philagrius. We don't know why Philagrius had it out for Athanasius so much. Athanasius himself simply calls him an enemy of the church. But Philagrius will show up periodically in our narrative throughout the next 15 years, always as an imperial official eager to help Athanasius's enemies. When the Mareotis Commission arrived at their destination, Philagrius made sure the full force of the local imperial administration was at their disposal. Whether or not the charges of Ischyrus were true, the commission and its allies were going to find whatever evidence and testimony they needed to convict, even if they had to resort to violence and torture to get it. All this did not go unopposed. Supporters of Athanasius, both at Tyre and back in Egypt, wrote various letters of protest to both the council, Count Dionysius, and even Philagrius. From the moment the commission members were selected to the moment they began their investigation, opponents rallied against it by dispatching letters of protest. It was all for nothing, of course. The Eusebians still held all the cards. The Council of Tyre had dragged on for a few months now. So long, in fact, that while the Mareotis Commission was doing its work, the celebrations at Jerusalem would soon be starting. The remaining members of the synod then packed up and left for Palestine. Athanasius and Macarius, meanwhile, remained in Tyre under guard, along with the Egyptian bishops. The Council of Jerusalem was a much more lavish affair, consisting of some 200 bishops in all, including a bishop from the Persian Empire. Great pomp accompanied the dedication ceremonies. The festivities began on September 13th and continued for 8 days. Bishop Maximus naturally took the leading role, and the true cross was exalted before the assembly. Though the emperor himself was not present, imperial officials represented him and presented ornate, beautiful gifts for the new church buildings. The emperor's representatives also hosted banquets for the bishops and distributed money and clothing to the poor and needy. Many bishops also delivered sermons celebrating the new constructions and praising the emperor, including, of course, the local metropolitan, Eusebius of Caesarea. The holy city was at last a Christian city. The Council of Jerusalem also had another matter to address. Having survived his summons to the imperial court back in 333, Arius's new profession of faith had been found adequate. So Constantine asked the council to personally review Arius and his followers and readmit them into communion if found acceptable. This the synod duly did, and Arius, Eusoius, and others were received by the assembled bishops in Jerusalem. Even bishops like Maximus himself, who would normally be skeptical of Arius, found themselves somewhat overwhelmed by the celebrations and imperial sponsorship. Truth be told, no one wanted to be the killjoy who rejected the emperor's calls for peace amidst the dedication of the holiest site in the Christian world. The synod issued an encyclical communicating its decisions, declaring the personal creed submitted by the Arians reflected the apostolic tradition. By October, the bishops had returned to Tyre, and not long after were joined by the Mariatus Commission. Judgment would now be pronounced. Athanasius wasn't going to wait around, though, for what he knew would be a guilty verdict. Under the cover of night, the Bishop of Alexandria managed to escape the city, making his way past the guards at the harbor. Boarding a raft, Athanasius made his way to a friendly port, and from there set sail north. When the Council of Tyre reconvened, it quickly discovered their defendant had fled the city. The summary report of the Mariatus Commission was reviewed. Despite complaining that Athanasius and his allies had removed witnesses, the commission members claimed they had found enough evidence to prove the charge of breaking the chalice of Ischyrus. The council then proceeded to condemn and depose Athanasius, not only on the grounds of breaking the chalice, but also for fleeing Tyre, which the council said betrayed his guilt, for not attending the Council of Caesarea the previous year, showing contempt for both the emperor and church councils, and finally, for bringing the nearly 50 uninvited Egyptian bishops to Tyre, which the council ridiculed as a gang of disorderly thugs. The council further forbade Athanasius to return to Alexandria on the grounds of preventing more troubles in Egypt. Finally, the synod elected and consecrated a new bishop of Alexandria. The Eusebians quickly deduced where their prey had fled. After wrapping things up in Tyre, the Eusebii, Theognis, Patrophilus of Scythopolis, and Valens and Ursatius hightailed it out of Tyre and began racing north. Hot on their heels, though, were five of the Egyptian bishops loyal to Athanasius. Athanasius arrived in Constantinople on October 30th to make his appeal to Constantine directly. Unfortunately, the emperor was currently away in the Balkans. A week later, though, Constantine returned to the capital. As the emperor rode in on his horse, Athanasius accosted him in the streets while the imperial procession passed by. Athanasius was in such a disheveled state that the emperor didn't even recognize him. But once Constantine realized who he was, the emperor was moved with first pity and then anger. The emperor had always held a good opinion of Athanasius, and to see him in such a lowly state, brought about by fellow Christians no less, angered the emperor mightily. Athanasius simply requested that he and his opponents be given an audience so the bishop could relay all the sufferings he had received. The emperor immediately dispatched a letter of summons to the Council of Tyre to this effect. Mere hours after the dispatch went out, though, Eusebius of Nicomedia and company arrived in Constantinople, as did the five Egyptian bishops. And so, the imperial audience commenced that very day. It became immediately apparent to the Eusebians that the emperor had dismissed the Council of Tyre as an improper synod which had acted with extreme prejudice, and therefore its decisions, whatever they were, had no authority. Athanasius had managed to persuade the emperor of this conclusion before Constantine had even read the council's own report. Once again, it appeared that, at the last moment, Athanasius had successfully outmaneuvered his enemies, just as he had done so the previous year. But then, Eusebius of Nicomedia deployed the trump card. Realizing none of their previous accusations and decisions would turn the emperor now, Eusebius raised a new charge, one which he knew all too well would incite imperial wrath. Eusebius accused Athanasius of threatening to withhold the grain supply from Alexandria to Constantinople. Like a raging storm which all of a sudden makes a sharp turn, Constantine's ire shifted away from the Eusebians and onto Athanasius. Now, before going any further, we should unpack this new accusation. As many of you know, Egypt was the breadbasket of the ancient Mediterranean, and as a result, it was arguably the most important province in the Roman Empire. Its grain shipments were tightly controlled by the imperial government. The city of Rome had been able to balloon to such an immense size because of the grain it received from both North Africa and Egypt. Back in 332, Constantine had diverted the Egyptian supply to Constantinople, allowing New Rome to now also have the free grain dole allotment handed out to its citizens. To risk the grain shipments from Alexandria to the new capital risked the very stability of the empire and the throne of the emperor himself. Messing with the empire's breadbasket was high treason. It was not something you even joked about. Only a couple years earlier, the famous philosopher Sopater of Apamea had been accused of using magic to ferret the winds so the grain ships wouldn't reach the city. The emperor wasted no time in having the philosopher beheaded. In addition to the extreme seriousness of this charge, there is also the fact that it was even credible. Here we are, only a couple decades after Constantine's conversion, and Christian leaders like Athanasius already possess enough power and influence to theoretically interfere with one of the most vital exchanges of goods in the imperial economy. We've already discussed before how Constantine channeled his imperial largesse through the bishops, and Alexandria was no different. For the charitable purpose of doing the Lord's work of feeding the poor and the hungry, Constantine had granted the bishops of Alexandria access to the Egyptian grain supply. We saw the same subsidy system at play in the linen tunics affair last episode. Because of Constantine, bishops now had real access to imperial resources for the purposes of Christian charity and other services. To many poor and widowed Alexandrians, Athanasius wasn't just their spiritual father, but also the man who, by virtue of his ecclesiastical office, provided them with clothing and food on a regular basis. Though certainly born out of pious convictions, Constantine's program of Christian charity had major political implications. It dramatically raised the prestige and power of the office of bishop. When Constantine demanded that Athanasius provide an explanation for the new charge, the bishop of Alexandria was at a loss for words. Well, the right words, anyway. Just as he was preparing to be vindicated again, Athanasius now found himself on the outs with the Augustus. Athanasius began to verbally flail about in a desperate attempt to convince Constantine that there was absolutely no basis to the allegation he had treasonously interfered with the grain shipments. In the end, though, the Bishop of Alexandria lost his temper and warned the emperor that God would ultimately judge between the two of them. That proved to be enough for Constantine. The following day, November 7th, Athanasius was sent off into exile at the Gallic capital of Trier. After nearly a decade, the Miletians and Eusebians had at long last succeeded in getting Athanasius banished. Athanasius' supporters back home didn't take the news well. Protests and rioting followed in Alexandria, and petitions were sent to the imperial court. Most notable among the latter was Antony of Egypt, father of the monks. Alas, even the intervention of the great holy man was not enough to change the emperor's mind. Constantine responded to Antony calmly, but firmly, that Athanasius was a troublemaker and that his banishment was justified. The Eusebian Miletian victory was not total, though. Since Constantine had disavowed the Council of Tyre, Its deposition and replacement of Athanasius was not considered legally binding. Therefore, as odd as it sounds, Athanasius was still technically Bishop of Alexandria. Constantine had simply chosen to exile him until the emperor finally decided what to do about the whole situation. In the meantime, whoever the Council of Tyre had appointed in Athanasius's place was barred from taking up his new post. In addition, the enemies of Athanasius did not get off scot-free. The emperor did not grant the Synod of Tyre's decision to restore the Miletians legal force either. When the Miletians attempted to assume their new sees and stirred up divisions in the process, Constantine had their leader, John Arcaf, arrested and banished. Such a political decapitation turned out to have a major effect on the Miletians. Their movement had already splintered following the death of their founder. John's faction had been the largest and most well organized. With him now gone, the Miletians will cease to be major players in the ecclesiastical politics of the 4th century. Though they certainly don't vanish from the historical record, their appearances are fleeting and mostly confined to local Egyptian affairs. Such, of course, is not the case for the Eusebians. Next episode, Eusebius and his fellows will turn their attention toward their other great enemy, the man who, for many of them, was the true heresiarch of the age, Marcellus of Ancyra.